This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America's current poet laureate, Robert Haas, is not only a great poet, he's a great teacher and translator. His love of language is contagious. Haas edited a book of haiku by three Japanese masters. Most of those haiku were translated by Haas. A new edition of that book was recently published by Echo Press. And Echo has just published a new book of Haas's own poems called Sun Under Wood. It's been nominated for a National Book Award. The winner will be announced in November. Haas is the first poet laureate from the West Coast. He teaches at the University of California at Berkeley. I spoke with him last April at the tail end of the first ever National Poetry Month. As part of the celebration, Haas had organized a series of readings by nature writers. I asked Robert Haas to recite a poem by one of the writers he was working with.
There's a poem that sticks in my mind because when I was growing up when I was in high school, I guess, in California, Gary Snyder, now I guess it was in college, who was then one of the famous young beats, caught my attention. It was someone who got the rhythms of my particular world. This is a poem called Marin On, about Marin County, where I grew up, and it was like a haiku. Down valley, a smoke haze. 3 days heat after 5 days rain. Pitch glows on the fir cones. Swarms of new flies. I didn't know that something like that could be a poem, you know.
Why didn't you think that could be a poem?
Well, I guess I still had the idea that there was supposed to be an agon, a wrestling match at the center of a poem, that some subject had to be wrestled to the ground and its meaning rendered. And the absence of that in this poem, which is, of course, often there in the haiku too, and in the poems that I think of the Tang Dynasty Buddhist poets, which is probably more closely related to, the absence of that is the point. You know, it sits you down in being for a second in a way that's startling. And I just love the sounds of it. Pitch glows on the fir cones, swarms of new flies.
You said that you thought the Gary Snyder poem that you accepted for us had some similarities to haiku. You've translated a lot of haiku mm-hmm. into English mm-hmm. over the years. What makes a haiku a haiku?
Well, that's a good question. Issa, who was a 19th century haiku poet, moved back to his father's farm when he was in middle age, and the local lord, Damyo in Japanese, wanted to honor his presence, so he sponsored a poetry contest with some fairly large prize on the theme of new snow. Each haiku has a seasonal word in it. It's a reference to some time of year that usually has traditional symbolic associations. New snow has associations with freshness and cleanness and purity. And so the poem that Basho wrote for this went something like, writing crap about new snow for rich people is not haiku. In 17 syllables, on the theme of freshness and purity. It's a perfectly correct haiku. I think for most people, the definition of it involves plain language, an act of attention to the immediate moment. In Japanese, it was composed of 17 syllables and a kind of rhythmic units of 5 syllables, 7 syllables, 5 syllables. And it intended to be mostly absolutely attentive to the present, and it had this element of seasonal reference always.
Would you recite a favorite for us?
Yeah. Well, one of my every Japanese poet had to write a poem at one time or another about Mount Fuji, and the greatest of the haiku poets, Basho, wrote one that goes, "Misty fall, can't see Fuji." Interesting. That was the first poem about not seeing Mount Fuji that got written.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that one.
You've translated a lot of haiku. What really appeals to you about the form?
Well, what appealed to me about it in the first place was just its clear-mindedness. You know, I just loved the clarity and plainness of the seeing. I didn't understand why later I came to see that, unlike most of Western poetry, it's not a theistic, it's not trying to read God's hand in creation. Not that I don't like this tradition, I love this tradition, but if you think about oh, think about two New England poems. One that I love that's appropriate this time of year is Robert Frost's Nothing Gold Can Stay. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. It's only so an hour, then leaf subsides to leaf. So Eden sank to grief, so dawn goes down to day. Nothing gold can stay. That poem, which begins with this, you know, very specific observation that the first fuzz on the bare woods in early spring is a kind of sheen of gold, then goes on to moralize it in a specific way.
Right.
I think another great example of this tradition, it's really a tradition of New England Protestant inwardness, I think, one of the great poems in American speech is Emily Dickinson's Certain Slant of Light. You know, there's a certain slant of light, winter afternoons, that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Heavenly hurt it gives us, we can find no scar, but internal difference where the meanings are. None can touch it, any. 'Tis the sealed despair, an imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens, shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death. She starts with that shaft of afternoon light and immediately goes inside to this kind of, shockingly modern, painful...
Inner desolation.
Yeah, inner desolation. And we talk about Emily Dickinson all day, a desolation that's preferable to deadness of feeling. I mean, in that poem, that seems like the two choices.
So in comparing this New England style that you're talking about with haiku is just more purely descriptive, more gazing outward than inward?
Well, I think there's a famous story about Basho that one of his students, Kikaku, came to him and showed him a poem, and Basho looked at it and shrugged and said, the trouble with most poetry is that it's either objective or subjective. And Kikaku, the straight man, said, you mean too objective or too subjective? And Basho said, no. In theory, of course, it's like with that, I think it's true of any great art in a way, in some way anyway, that there's a kind of perfect fusion of the outer and inner in the best of it, wherever it seems to be located. Later, he would write poems that would go, this one has a little title, At a Monastery. Late fall getting dinner, we peeled cucumbers, eggplants.
Right, now that seems like... In some way, just such a factual recording.
Yeah. So many times his poems just say, is.
Uh-huh.
Here's being. You don't have to be in torment for it to be real to you. You don't have to push it up against mortality for it to be real to you, because it's always pushed up against mortality.
There's a haiku of Basho's that I particularly love that you've included in your anthology of haiku. I'm going to ask you to read it for us. It's about the summer moon.
Yeah. It's not like anything they compare it to, the summer moon. It's the whole poem.
I just think that's so lovely.
Yeah. The one poem of his that does this inward turn that I know, I mean, there are a few, actually, but is one that I love, goes, deep autumn, my neighbor, how does he live, I wonder?
Mm-hmm.
I think he could be a powerful psychologist, even in this tiny form sometimes. He has another poem that goes, the famous thing, like the cherry blossoms in Washington, the famous thing about spring in Japan was the cuckoo birds in Kyoto, and people would go to Kyoto to see the cuckoos, so which were Himalayan cuckoos, migratory birds that only hit Japan in the early spring. And he has a poem that goes, even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoos cry, I long for Kyoto.
I like that one a lot, too.
I do, too.
Yeah, that the reality is never quite measures up to.
I don't know if it doesn't quite measure up. I don't know if the reality doesn't quite measure up to, but or to defend ourselves against a reality, we rehabilitate desire instantly to put ourselves back in our real condition, which is permanent longing.
Yes, right. The real condition of permanent longing. Well put. In your anthology of haiku, you included Basho's death poem. I'm going to ask you to recite that. And what does it mean, his death poem? Did he know he was dying?
Yes, he did know he was dying. And in his last years, he was sort of troubled. He came to feel like he should really be involved in religious practice and stop this frivolous business of writing poetry. And he just couldn't stop writing poetry. The seasonal phrase in this poem is the withered fields. It means uncultivated fields. The English translations of this, British translations always say moor to distinguish it from crop fields, but it means withered fields, has a peculiar sense of desolation for the Japanese in the 17th century. And this poem goes, "Sick on a journey, my dreams wander the withered fields." And I think he knew he was dying, and I think that though he was a religious poet and he wanted to come to a sense of peace, he saw himself dying at the end with this machine of longing in him still throwing up images, still trying to make poetry. "Sick on a journey, my dreams wander the withered fields."
That's really beautiful. Now, all the poems that you've recited for us today, you've done from memory.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there's a lot of poetry that you just carry around in your mind.
Yeah.
Now, did you... I know when I was in school and I was supposed to memorize a poem, it would be work to memorize it. I don't have a good memory. Are these poems that you have worked to commit to memory, or do they just stay with you?
These are, I think, probably they're all ones that just stay with me. There are poems, lots of poems, that I've committed to memory and worked at it. And I believe even with college students, I never teach a poetry class in which I don't ask them to memorize at least three poems. Partly on the theory that what I say to them is going to be like duck off water off a... This is a great metaphor, isn't it? Water off a duck's back. Have you ever heard that one?
No, oh, never.
But that they go, you know, if they go away with the poems, they'll have got what they came for. So I like doing that. And I think that it's how we, you know, it's the ancient way that we made them at home in us.
Right. You know, I figure in a way that, to use a food analogy, if you are, excuse the expression, if you are what you eat,
yeah.
that if you kind of like absorb poems or songs into your body, that somehow they transform you in some small but swell way.
I think so. You know, I mean, one hopes so. Of course, we also incorporate all kinds of awful language in our heads, and then language that is... who knows
mm-hmm.
what purpose? You'll wonder where the yellow went if you brush your teeth with Pepsodent.
That's right.
Is it?
I got a lot of that in my mind.
Though some poets, you know, it was Lou Welch, one of the early beat poets, who wrote the famous haiku, "Raid Kills Bugs Dead."
Wait, who'd you say wrote that?
Lou Welch. You know, he was a comrade of Gary Snyder and
Allen
Ginsberg.
I had no idea.
And he worked briefly for an advertising agency in San Francisco in the 50s, and he is the author of that well-known haiku.
Well, Poet Laureate of the United States, is that well-written? It sure stuck in America's mind.
It's great, isn't it? It just says it. "Raid kills bugs dead." Now, that's my idea of poetry.
Robert Hass is America's Poet Laureate. His new book of poems, Sun Under Wood, is nominated for a National Book Award. This is Fresh Air.